It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time of the year. It's the happiest season of all. With those holiday greetings and gay happy meetings when friends come to call. It's the happiest season of all. There'll be parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling out in the snow. There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago.
Welcome back to Midnight in the Mountains. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing fantastic today. I'm looking forward to this Christmas special that we're going to be doing.
Yeah, I am so excited. I have so much information to share with you.
And I got a couple good stories too, a couple ones that maybe nobody's heard about. And I've learned a lot more about Christmas monsters than I thought I ever would.
It's a good topic. There's so much. I guess we should just get right into
it, right?
Let's do
it. Let's dive right in and give some people some information.
So to start out here, there's so much information on these topics that it's very hard to find, you know, an exact story because these stories are so old. I mean, I did my best to kind of compare notes from a lot of different sources and kind of try to take the most reoccurring theme. So that's basically what I did with all this information that I have. So I'm going to start back, way back, probably the first Christmas, quote unquote, monster I have. It dates back to the pagan times and it dates back to Yule, to the winter solstice, which we know from our previous episode that was the earliest winter festival. So I have Odin's Wild Hunt, and this was something that was feared all throughout the Germanic lands of Northern Europe. And this took place during the harsh winter. So the pagan god of the underworld, Odin, flew through the sky on his eight-legged horse named Zelfnir. And his son rode alongside of him. His son was Thor, the god of thunder. And they'd be riding through these dark winter skies at night. And they would have all these ghosts of the dead following them through their wild hunt. Odin would have ravens that would fly with them, and they would kind of be like their scouts to go through the forest. And the folklore said that you needed to be inside because Odin would get you and abduct you and take you back to the underworld with him. So this was kind of like a tale to keep you inside, to keep you safe from the winter cold, because, you know, if you're out in the harsh cold winter conditions, you're probably going to die because no one's probably going to find you. Oh, I forgot to also mention that Thor rode through the sky in a chariot pulled by two goats. If you jump back to our Haunted Places 2 episode, very last minute, I decided to cover the Black Forest in Germany, and I went over the Grimm brothers who came from this region and wrote about this region and put all these folklore tales into their fairy tale books, which they also did write other books on German mythologies. So lo and behold, Jacob Grimm, one of the Grimm brothers, published The Wild Hunt in one of his German mythology books in 1835.
And you can kind of see how that particular story is kind of, if you look really broadly, how it's kind of morphed into present day Christmas. That's how we see it, with Santa Claus flying his sleigh, having his, of course, he has eight reindeer instead of an eight-legged reindeer or eight-legged demon.
Demon horse.
So yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know, a lot of these stories come from the Northern Europe. Really shows how our ancestors really viewed, you know, how dark it gets. Because if you think about it, you know, in the wintertime, you're only getting about 8 to 9 hours of daylight, depending on how far north you are. You know, the farther north you get, the less hours of daylight. Scandinavia, Iceland, I think, only gets like 4 hours or 5 hours per day because they're so far north. So if you think about it, around Christmas time, these particular areas, it's dark 16 hours, or no, it's dark 20 hours out of the day, or 19 hours out of the day. So you can see why they'd want to be sitting around the fire, you know, making up stories just to kind of entertain themselves, because you couldn't really go outside. You couldn't, I mean, you could, but you probably wouldn't want to.
Yeah, it's all pretty much these mythological stories and folklore and legends to keep you safe from the winter. But there's also that part of it that's kind of spooky if you think about it, that makes me wonder if any of this stuff isn't actually or wasn't actually real. And I'm going to kind of get into that a little bit way farther down the line after we discuss a few other things.
Yeah, I mean, you do have a good point there. You know, it could be like there could be a figment of truth in there that's been elaborated on for 2,000 years.
I would think there'd have to be, because it's kind of, where do these stories come from?
You know, it could be just the fragment of truth. Could be something as simple as a reindeer they saw in the shadows that looked like it had 8 legs.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, like just something like that, right?
Right. That's actually really smart.
So for my first story, mine is going to be a part of the Icelandic tradition of Christmas. It's called Grýla, the Yule Lads, and the Yule Cat, which these are all kind of tied together. So these guys are going to be, according to the Iceland folk tradition, these are mountain-dwelling characters and monsters who show up in town during the holidays. It's all meant for the kids, you know, to make sure that they behave well. And they have these pranksters who sneak around leaving gifts at night, but there are also monsters who gobble up naughty kids. So picture this. There's Grýla, this ogress who loves eating mischievous children, cooking them up in a huge pot. Her husband, Leipoldi, and he's just pretty lazy and hangs out in the cave. There's also this massive, ferocious cat called the Yule Cat. It prowls around the snowy countryside during Christmas and chomps down on people who don't get any new clothes before Christmas Eve. And don't forget the Yule Lads. They're Grýla's and Leopold's 13 mischievous sons. They all got names that describe how they like to cause trouble. They show up one by one during the last 13 nights before Christmas, leaving little gifts and kids' shoes on the windowsill. But if a kid's been naughty, they leave a gross, old, rotten potato instead. These stories have been around since the 17th century, but they've changed a bit over time, depending on where and when they were told. Nowadays, these characters have taken on a slightly kinder roles. So that's kind of like a broad description. And so I got a little bit on each one, just a little more information. So Grýla, the formidable Christmas witch from Iceland, living in a cave with a brood of strange creatures, she terrorizes towns, snatches misbehaving kids, and turns them into a stew. Grýla's tales trace back to the 13th century in oral accounts, evolving into written references in historic sagas and poems. Iceland's midwinter holiday, known as Jól, which is spelled J-O-L, has a darker tone than in the U.S., with celebrations uniting relatives, living and deceased, and welcoming magical creatures like elves and trolls. Grýla, associated with a threatening presence in the mountains, was among these figures, appearing with a horned tail and a bag to gather naughty children. Grýla, as depicted in Icelandic folklore, is described as a menacing and grotesque figure, often portrayed as a fearsome and ugly troll-like creature. However, the specific details of her appearance vary across different tales and legends, contributing to a somewhat ambiguous and varied description. Some accounts describe Grýla as an immense giant with multiple tails, which may range from 15 to 40, each supposedly holding bags containing misbehaving children destined to become her feast. In some versions, she's also said to possess numerous heads, possibly 300, each adorned with 3 eyes. These tales depict her as a horrifying figure with features like a matted beard, blackened teeth, ears that hang long enough to reach her nose, and even hooves. Her appearance is often consistently described as very ugly, emphasizing her terrifying nature. Despite these consistent elements of her frightful appearance, specific details can differ among the various Icelandic folktales, contributing to the folklore's eerie and captivating essence. Accompanying Grýla in her eerie saga of tales of a man-eating Yule Cat, and her mob of 13 adult sons, the mischievously Yule Lads. Each lad had unique antics, from slamming doors to swiping sausages. And although Gryla wasn't initially tied to Christmas, later poems merged her with the Yule Lads and Yule Cats, solidifying her connections to the holiday. Seen as a personification of winter and darkness, Gryla represents the threat of a harsh Icelandic environment, and in the eyes of the local, mythical creatures like Gryla held sway over the land, a notion Krampus could only dream of, making Gryla an archetypical and intimidating villain in Icelandic folklore. So, I think what struck me so much about this, and this kind of ties into the, like, Iceland during this time of the year not having a whole lot of daylight, is, you know, this is a very terrifying figure that hides in the mountains, that is, the best way to put it, is a villain. You know, she's snatching children, turning them into stew and eating them. I mean, what? How much more grotesque could you get?
I got some other ones coming your way that, I mean, that one's pretty bad, but the other one I have is, yeah, probably about just as bad.
Sweet. So, along with Gryla, we also have the Yule Lads. So, the Yule Lads is a pretty unique take on A Christmas Story, which, as an aside, when I was reading through this, my mind kept going back to the, like, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh my gosh, which yes.
It really, like, when I'm reading through this, that's all I could think about. But I couldn't find any references where Disney or the Brothers Grimm had taken from the story. But it sounds, even though the numbers aren't the same, when I start, like, saying their names and what they do, you'll see exactly what I mean. So, anyways, we'll get to that in a second. So, the Yule Lads, one way it was explained is that instead of just having a Santa Claus, they have these 13 of these mischievous Father Christmases. These Yule Lads take turns visiting kids in the 13 nights before Christmas, and kids put their shoes on the windowsill, and if they've been good, they get candy in their shoe. But if not, the Yule Lads leave a not-so-nice surprise, rotten potatoes. The Yule Lads first appeared in the 17th century poem of Gryla. Before that, Gryla was seen as a troll in the older stories, but wasn't linked to Christmas. She's described as this terrifying being who's the mom of these huge Yule Lads known for giving kids a fright. Back then, the number and how they looked varied a lot depending on where you were. They were used to scare kids into misbehaving, kind of like the boogeyman. Even the King of Denmark wasn't cool with using them to discipline kids. The Yule Lads used to be way scarier in stories long ago, but in 1746, parents got banned from telling those monster stories, and now they're more into harmless pranks. It wasn't until the late 18th century that a poem mentioned all 13 of them. Then in the mid-19th century, John Arason got inspired by the Brothers Grimm and started collecting folktales. And guess what? His collection in 1862 was the first time the names of the Yule Lads were mentioned. Fast forward to 1932 when the poem Yule Lads got published in a Christmas book, The Christmas is Coming, by Johannes Koltum. That poem made them popular and set the record for the 13 Yule Lads we know today with their names and personalities. So as of today, here's the 13 of them with their names and then just a short description. There's Sheep Coat Clod, and he tries to suckle ewes in farmers' sheep sheds. Gully Gawk, he steals foam from buckets of cow milk. Stubby, he's short and steals food from frying pans. Spoon Licker, he licks spoons. Obvious. Pot Scraper, or Pot Licker, he steals unwashed pots and pans and licks them clean. You have Bowl Licker, he steals bowls of food from under the bed. Because back in the old days, Icelanders used to sometimes store their bowls of food under their bed. Door Slammer, he stomps around and slams door, keeping everyone awake. Skier Gobbler?
Is it Skier?
He eats up all... Oh, it might be.
Is that?
S-K-Y-R?
Yeah. Is that Icelandic yogurt? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So how do you say it? Sky?
I think it's Skier, but don't freaking quote me on that.
Oh, I'm quoting you on that. So Laura says that I should say...
Send me your correction emails.
So, Skier Gobbler, he eats up all the Icelandic yogurt. Sausage Swiper, he loves stolen sausages. Window Peeper, he likes to creep outside windows and sometimes steal the stuff he sees inside. door sniffer. He has a huge nose and an insatiable appetite for stolen baked goods. Meat hook. He snatches up any meat left out, especially smoked lamb. And candle beggar. He steals candles, which used to be sought after items in Iceland. So now that I've read all those, you should be able to see the similarities between them and the seven dwarves. You know, you have Sleepy, who's always sleepy. You know, all the dwarves, their names basically describe who they are. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what this guy did back in 1932, where he, to me, it seemed like he made up the names just to kind of go along with the story. That's my take on it, like, because it's never been recorded down their names in any of the previous poems or texts or anything like that. So, yeah, Mr. Johann Coltum has added to the story at this point.
Oh, so it wasn't one of the Grimm brothers that named the Yule lads?
No.
Okay.
No. It was Johann Coltum. It's a poem called The Yule Lads.
I wonder if like you said, I wonder if the Grimm brothers, because they were responsible for Snow White, and I actually, Snow White was one of the ones that I did touch on and kind of gave the history of in our other episode. Yeah, I wonder if he took inspiration from that to make the Seven Dwarves, because in the original Snow White story, there was really nothing that said anything about dwarves that I can remember, if I'm remembering correctly.
Very well could be. You know, a lot of things, you know, people build stories on other stories. You know, they just kind of compound each other.
And I mean, that's kind of what the Grimm brothers did, because none of their stories were originally their own. Now, I mean, maybe down the line, maybe they wrote stuff, but basically they took a bunch of folklore and then they added their own little pieces to it when they wrote their fairy tales.
Right, right. Because the one that sticks out to me is Hansel and Gretel.
Yep.
Like the original story of Hansel and Gretel is like absolutely terrifying. And they kind of made it more into a fairy tale, you know, something that's a little bit. Or do I have it backwards?
You do, because the Grimm brothers, their stuff was really, like,
dark. Yeah. That's right. And Disney, or, like, later on, they basically made, and I say Disney, but it was basically Disney.
Yeah.
Basically made it into, like, a more of a children's story. That's mm-hmm. right.
Yeah, because they kind of switched to making things a little softer because it was more marketable to, like, children. And it was obviously right. being more marketable, that means more money, so.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of interesting to, you know, the similarities there for sure.
And I have another one I want to grab out of the story, which Gryla, you said she'd kill children or people who did not have new wool clothing on.
So that's the Yule Cat.
Okay.
And that's going to be the next on the list. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So the Yule Cat is known as a word that I'm not even going to try to pronounce because it's all consonants with like four vowels in it. And there's a lot of dots over things. But it's, if I have to try, it's Jökulturm. And in Icelandic folklore is a monstrous and gigantic feline creature that features prominently in Icelandic Christmas tradition. The origins and appearances of the Yule Cat are rooted in legends that have evolved over the centuries. Legend has it that the Yule Cat prowls the countryside of Iceland during the Christmas season, specifically on Christmas Eve. The cat is said to be enormous, menacing, and entirely black in color. It emerges under the cover of darkness, lurking in the snowy landscapes, and has been associated with threatening children who don't receive new clothing as gifts during the holiday festivities. Accounts vary, but it is generally depicted as an immense black cat, sometimes described as monstrously huge, towering over buildings, with eyes that gleam like embers. According to Icelandic folklore, the Yule Cat has been linked to a tradition where new clothes were given as gifts during Christmas. Children who don't receive new clothing before Christmas Eve were said to be at risk of encountering the Yule Cat, which could lead to dire consequences, potentially devouring those without new attire. The origins of the Yule Cat legend are somewhat obscure and have ties to an old tradition where new clothes symbolize prosperity and hard work. The Yule Cat's association with new attire became a way to encourage hard work and reward those who contributed to the household's chores or work on the farms by providing them with new clothing for Christmas. Over time, this tradition transformed into a cautionary tale about the Yule Cat, emphasizing the importance of diligence and rewarding hard work during the holiday season. When I first was reading through this, I really thought this was going to be like a more menacing type figure in such a way where it was like more central to the story. But the more I read about it, it's more of a way, like the last paragraph I said, it's more of a way to get people to be more prosperous with spinning their wool is one of the stories, because that was a big thing in Iceland, that in Iceland they would have to be very hardworking to make their wool clothing. And if all the new kids had one item, that means that the entire town was very prosperous, was very hardworking. And so this was just kind of a way to encourage that type of behavior.
Right. Also meaning that they're not going to freeze to death during the winter, too. That it all kind of goes back to the whole survivalist thing of the time. And that's a very important thought, I guess you could say. Kind of ties into some other folklore stories.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like, you know, all these tales are, even though they're stories presented for a reason. Even if the reason's not like immediately obvious, Yule Cat, you know, so they're hardworking. And the Yule Lads is so the kids will behave during this important holiday season. And Gryla, you know, something to entertain them during the long dark, during the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was super interesting. I've actually, before this episode, I've never heard of Gryla. Never heard of the Yule Lads or the Yule Cat. So it was really fun to kind of read through those and, you know, get a good feeling for them.
Yeah, I really like to hear about them. I think it's like, it's just kind of funny. There are also a bunch of just like these like creepy pain in the asses that kind of just will break in your house and wreak havoc if you're not careful.
And some of them are kind of like, you know, a little weird, like pot liquor.
Yeah.
You know, like why? Why? Well, you know, actually now that I think about it, you know, a pot liquor could be a way of getting kids to do the dishes.
Oh.
So they didn't get them stolen.
Right.
You know, you could think of it that way. Now that, you know, I'm kind of considering it, all those are pretty important chores that kids might have, you know, had to do back then. You know, they had to make sure that their spoons were clean, their pots were clean, their bowls were clean. You want to make sure that you eat all your yogurt so that Skier Gobbler doesn't get it, or the sausage. You know, like, you know, eat all your food, do your dishes, do your chores, or, you know, something bad's going to happen. Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you think about it that way.
I didn't even put two and two together till you explained that. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah, I just came up with that. It just literally clicked when I was reading through here.
It really makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even like the last one, the candle beggar, you know, I could see where candles being very, very important because they didn't have electricity. You know, they would have had fire and candles and maybe lanterns.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly.
And I mean, candles were a lot of work to make back in the day. You had to butcher your animal. You took the fat. You rendered the fat. You had to get the wicks and dip it in the hot fat and just creating your candle. So, I mean, those were precious items.
Yeah. Yeah. It's super interesting when you think about it. It gives you a different perspective. You know, when you go through and read the names, you're like, oh, this is kind of weird. Well, it's not really weird if you consider the time that they were created.
And actually, if you want to check out our Instagram, midnight_in_the_mountains, I had found this website. It's probably the same one that Aaron used, but it has like a picture of each Yule Lad and on what night they come, and kind of gives like their favorite things and a little bit about their personality and explains what they do. So I've just been like screenshotting each day and kind of putting it up on the Instagram story, because I think it's just something kind of fun to add to it.
Heck yeah.
So next up on the list, we have Krampus. He's probably my favorite as far as considered evil goes. It's kind of hard to tell the origins of Krampus. He's either from Germany or Austria. It's kind of the same area where the borders meet. Now picture this. He is a very large, very intimidating creature. He is very tall. He's got black fur, cloven hooves, horns, and he resembles a goat, and he has a very long pointed tongue. He is a lot of the times depicted as like this devilish like creature. And he actually goes hand in hand with Saint Nicholas, but I'm going to get into that a little bit later. You can actually tie Krampus back to pagan folklore. Krampus is supposed to be the son of the goddess Hel of the underworld, and it's spelled H-E-L, so it's not like the word hell that we would think of, and that's her name. So Krampus is supposed to represent the dark nights, and just picture this creature walking through these snowy Alps in harsh blizzard winter conditions. He dates back to the first century BC, and the pagans actually held a festival for Krampus around the 5th or the 6th of December, and they would all dress in costumes. They would kind of do what was called a Krampuslauf, translating to Krampus run, and they'd dress up like a Krampus. They'd have cowbells, sticks, torches, and their point of doing this was to disperse and dispense the evil spirits of the winter. So these festivals were held for a long time. It's possible that Krampus got integrated into Christian beliefs in Bavaria after the 30 Years' War, which dated after 1648. And the lore was meant to teach obedience. Krampusnacht is December 5th. It is the eve before St. Nicholas Day. Krampus came around from house to house, hitting the bad children with a switch made from birch, and or he would stuff them in his sack and take them back to his lair. And you didn't really know what happened to those children. They would just disappear forever. It's said that Krampus probably took them back to his lair up in the Alpine Mountains and ate these children. When it got to this point in time, Krampus would come the day before St. Nicholas Day. So it was kind of like Krampus would weed out the bad children for St. Nicholas to come. He'd come on the 5th, take the bad children away. So the next day, when St. Nicholas would come to bring gifts, he didn't have to worry about anything. He knew everybody there was good. He would just give them gifts and be on his way. He didn't have to worry about if the kids were bad or good or not, because Krampus already got the naughty ones. In the 17th and 18th centuries, in the mountainous areas of Austria and Bavaria, Germany, they would have parades that most likely did include Krampus. And today, Krampus is all over the world, with festivals being held around the 5th of December. Krampus runs are still done in like a parade-like fashion over in Germany, Austria, Slovenia, Czech Republic, Hungary, and also parts of the U.S.
Have you ever been to a Krampus run?
No, but I want to so badly. I saw that there's one over in Pittsburgh, but that's not close to me. But I'm like, maybe I'm going to have to make a trip next year.
That'd be kind of fun.
It would be so much fun.
Yes.
All right. So next up, we have St. Nicholas. And St. Nicholas goes alongside of Krampus. And so St. Nicholas is obviously a good person. He is not a Christmas villain or a winter solstice villain or anything like that. But you can't really explain this stuff without including him. St. Nicholas was born in the 3rd century, possibly around 280, to wealthy parents in Patara, seaside town in Asia Minor, which is now modern-day Turkey. And at a very young age, he became a orphan, and he was left all of his parents' money. So he was raised as a Christian, and he remembered that in the gospel, there was a man who had taken all of his money, all of his wealth, and turned around and helped other needy people. So this inspired Nicholas, and he turned around and did the exact same thing. He was eventually elected Bishop of Myra, and he became so well known. He was so loved for everything that he did, and all of his good doings kind of sparked legends and all the talk of these legends began to flourish. He was considered the patron saint of sailors, and he was also credited for stopping a very violent storm the one time and saving a bunch of people on the ship. He was also the patron saint of children. There is a very popular story of a father who had three daughters, and one of the daughters was to be married, but he could not afford the dowry to have his daughter be married. And he was actually going to take his three daughters and put them into prostitution. Somehow Saint Nicholas found out about this. So in the middle of the night, he went by, took a bag of golden coins and just tossed them in the window. So the father did not have to put his daughters into prostitution for this because now he could afford the dowry, which if you ask me, that seems extremely drastic. I don't know how. I mean, okay, I didn't live back then, but
where's the leap from like, okay, well, I can't pay for my daughters. Well, now you're going to have to be a prostitute.
Exactly.
Right? It's a huge jump there.
How about you just don't get married then instead of doing that to your children? I don't know.
You could say also, you know, if it was around St. Nicholas time, which was about 300 AD or, you know, give or take somewhere around that area, I think that women didn't actually have jobs per se. Like, they didn't go out. They stayed in the home and did, like, the cooking, the cleaning, the, you know, like, household duties. So, So there may not have been a way for them to support themselves without a husband.
Right.
Maybe. And if the father didn't want to support his three daughters, you know, I would assume that he would have to try to marry them off so that somebody else could support them, because at that particular time, women didn't, quote unquote, work as like a blacksmith or maybe not a farmer, but a merchant. Like, there was probably not women merchants, you know, things like that. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not that familiar with 300 AD women's rights.
I mean, you're probably pretty correct, but don't get me started on that, because that's a whole other subject that is going to get me fired up. Mad.
And I don't blame you. No, I mean, to us, you know, that's an interesting thing. To us, that seems like this huge jump. Like, you know, why would you go from, you know, marrying him to prostitution? But if you take it in perspective with the time, that may have not been that big of a leap of what was considered okay back then.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I'm going to move on from that. I have some other stories of some miraculous things that he was just Nicholas at this time. So the next story is that he was traveling one day and there were three young travelers headed to Athens, and they stopped at this inn, and the innkeeper actually robbed and then murdered these young travelers, and he stuffed their bodies inside the barrels. And Nicholas, I did find somewhere where it said that he had a dream about this, and in his dream, he saw this, and he prayed to God to save these children, and then it restored their bodies, and they came back to life. There's also another story that took place in France, and they were three small children that became lost while they were playing, and a butcher found them. The butcher, for whatever reason, was running low on his meat that day, so he decided to take the children and murder them, chop them up, and use them as meat.
Which sounds very reasonable.
Yeah, why not? And so St. Nicholas found out about this, and he scolded this butcher and did whatever he did, like, you know, righted the wrongs, and he prayed and brought these children back to life. And all these people were then returned and reunited with their families.
So we can talk about that just for a second. So the butcher, who finds three kids in the woods, on a whim decides, hey, I don't have enough meat for today. Let's slaughter some kids. And then Nicholas comes and scolds him over it. Like, does that just sound a little odd?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what he did to him. I forget what it said, but it wasn't anything drastic.
Yeah, it wasn't like divine retribution or anything. It was just like, hey, you know, it just strikes me as a little odd is all.
No, it's a very weird, very gross story.
Mm-hmm.
After a lifetime of righting wrongs, performing miracles, Nicholas passed away on December 6th in 343. And the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox celebrated this day for years by feasting and giving gifts. Places such as Germany and Poland, boys would dress up as bishops collecting for the poor. And they still celebrate this day around Europe today. So by the Middle Ages, his popularity spread through Europe and his legend spread to Netherlands, where it became combined with elves and sky chariots. And he eventually was named a saint. Saint Nicholas's name translated to Sinterklaas in Dutch. And he was depicted as tall with a white beard, dressed in red clerical robes. He would arrive by boat every December 6th with gifts or lumps of coal for the children at their homes. And Sinterklaas stories were thought to be brought to the New World by Dutch settlers in the Hudson River Valley of New York. So this is pretty interesting to me. So Washington Irving, who we know from the author of writing Sleepy Hollow, he was a New York native. He wrote a book titled The History of New York in 1809, and in this book, he portrayed St. Nicholas flying through the skies in a wagon, dropping presents down chimneys. And in 1823, another New Yorker, Clement Clark Moore, wrote a poem titled A Visit from St. Nicholas. Instead of him using a wagon, he portrayed him as in a sleigh pulled by 8 tiny reindeer. And during the Civil War, Thomas Nast, who, if you go back to our Winter Solstice episode, Aaron talked about Thomas Nast when he did his list of Santa Claus through the years. He published a series of images showing a jolly St. Nicholas who lived at the North Pole.
The one thing that that kind of stands out to me, and this kind of goes back to the last episode that we did, at the very end, I was going through like all the different ways that Santa Claus has been portrayed. And one of them that stands out to me is he had a birch switch, which ties back into Krampus, you know, and I caught that little reference. And then what you were just talking about too, you know, obviously, because Thomas Nast did the whole history about the thing. And it's kind of interesting to see how to tie the two together.
Birch is mentioned in some other things that I have to get into, and it made me start to think that I want to get into the symbolism of birch and why it was so important. I feel like there's probably a very interesting story there.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure there is. We can do symbolism of a lot of different things, to be fair.
Oh my God, this is a subject that I find it so interesting. I could just go on and on about it because it just goes off into so many different directions and it just ties into so many different things.
Yeah. Yep. Very true.
I'm going to step a little sideways and go back to the early 1800s, and I'm going to move from New York over to Pennsylvania. And in this time, there was many immigrants that came from Germany to Pennsylvania, and they were the Pennsylvania Germans, and they eventually became known as the Pennsylvania Dutch. When the Germans came over to Pennsylvania, they brought their traditions with them. They brought the legend of the Belschnickel. So Belschnickel actually translates to Nicholas in furs. So when you think of Belschnickel, think of a kind of rugged, outdoorsy, woodsy-looking man with a beard, some scraggly long hair, dressed in brown furs. Belschnickel originated in the Palatine region of Europe, which was a very large forested area in Germany. So over here in America, traditions continued, and the Belschnickel would be someone who would dress up in furs and travel from house to house in their town about a week or two before Christmas. And when he got there, he would take his birch switch, birch switches that he would carry with him.
Again.
And, yep, and bang on the windows and the doors, and he'd eventually come in the door to see the children of the household. He'd ask the children, "Have you been good this year?" And if they would answer honestly, they would get candies or they would get nuts. But if they lied to the Belschnickel, they would get switched. And there was also, you were also supposed to sing a song for the Belschnickel. And this was also just another thing that was supposed to basically keep your children in line. Keep them, you know, good through the year, that the Belschnickel's coming, you want to get your treats, you want to be good. I'm familiar with that because traditions around here, there are still places that actually have, they reenact a traditional Pennsylvania Dutch Christmas. And that does include the Belschnickel. I remember through even just being a kid, when the Belschnickel was coming, he'd be tapping on the windows and the doors and rattling everything. And I remember it always just like scared the hell out of me as a kid. And I freaking loved it. It was so good because you'd go into a room and it was only lit by the fireplace and it was dark and you couldn't really see the Belschnickel's face. When some of the people would dress up as him, they would kind of put like soot and dirt and make his face, you know, make his face darker so you couldn't really see who he was. And just a little
mysterious
just,
figure.
Yep, exactly. Just made it a little bit more scary. So that's something that I really like because the Pennsylvania Dutch, those are my people. So that's one of my favorites.
I think it's, you know, the more that we read about these stories, there's a reoccurring theme to a lot of them. And that is keeping your kids behaved.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems like that's over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. We just keep seeing that over and over. The next thing that I had to talk about when I was, you know, going through there trying to find like some stories about, you know, Gryla and the Yule lads, and I wanted to find some ones that were a little more obscure, like maybe some that you have not heard about. So I came across these ones. There's not a whole lot of information. I just kind of want to like bring them out and give a short little blurb about it. The first one's called the Mari Lwynd. And so this one is the Christmas Zombie Horse, which sounds amazing. But in Welsh folklore, the eerie specter known as the Mari Lwynd, a skeletal mare, emerges from beyond the grave, accompanied by other revenants, haunting the streets to serve as a reminder of the living world. The sole intent of this ghostly figure is to gain entry into homes. To ward off this undead horse, a battle of clever verses, often held on New Year's Eve, is engaged, typically with a puppeteer carrying a horse skull atop a pole covered in white fabric, symbolizing the presence of a spectral horse. Never heard of that. Kind of interesting. Another one that I have is, and this one's from France, this one's called Hans Trap. Is also known as Hans von Trotha, or simply Trap, is a folklore character primarily associated with the Alsace and Lorraine regions of France, particularly during the Christmas season. He's a figure in regional folklore tied to Christmas traditions, notably as a companion to St. Nicholas, although his story is much more sinister. According to legend, Hans Trap was a wealthy, cruel, and greedy man, often described as a sinister figure who made a pact with the devil. As punishment for his greed and cruelty, the Catholic Church excommunicated him, and he was subsequently banished into the forest where he resided as a scarecrow-like figure, hiding and preying on children. During the Christmas season, Hans Trap is said to disguise himself in straw or as a scarecrow to frighten misbehaving children, warning them to behave and obey their parents, or else he might take them away. He serves as a cautionary figure, aiming to scare children into good behavior. In some versions of the legend, he threatens to abduct or punish naughty children, emphasizing the consequences of disobedience. In contemporary celebrations, Hans Trap remains part of the local Christmas traditions, appearing in parades or festivals as a reminder to children to behave and respect others. The character's portrayal varies, but he generally represents a cautionary figure warning against the vices of greed, cruelty, and disobedience. And on that particular note, now that I sit here and read this through, the similarities to Ebenezer Scrooge comes up, where he was kind of a, you know, a cruel guy because he was very greedy. It just kind of popped in my head that there's some similarities between these two stories. Makes me wonder if they one influenced the other or not.
When did you say that story?
It didn't really have a date to it. I didn't see any dates at all, so I couldn't say. But it just, you know, makes me wonder.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was, you know, a greedy guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it, like the Scarecrow thing doesn't really go with Ebenezer Scrooge, but maybe whoever wrote Ebenezer Scrooge got some inspiration from this particular story.
You mean Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol?
Yes, yes, yeah. I couldn't think of it. It was right there. It was right there at the tip of the tongue, and it just wasn't coming out.
The most known. Yeah, anyways.
And so the next one I have is La Befana and Babushka.
La Befana.
So this, La Befana. See, this is why we're good together. You correct me, I correct you. It's good. La Befana. So in various regions like Italy, Russia, and parts of Eastern Europe, a character reminiscent of the fairy tale figure Mother Hole emerges. An enigmatic woman rewards industry and penalizes laziness. She embarks on an annual journey each January, riding a broomstick to join the three kings in their quest for the Christ child. As she visits home, she leaves behind cookies and gifts for the children she encounters along her route. So, do you know anything else about this particular one?
I do. I have some about her, but I have to go into more of another figure to get to her.
So the other figure, which I think is going to be Perkta, and it's also linked to one called Strugel. So during New Year's Eve, Perkta travels the land and rewards industrious and giving individuals while punishing the lazy and greedy. Her chosen penalty involves a gruesome act, slashing open the stomachs of the idol and replacing their intestines with straw, rocks, and refuse. The tradition of consuming goose during Christmas is associated with witches like Percha, often portrayed as having a goose foot, along the belief that goose aids witches in flight. So, to add on this particular one, in regions like Switzerland, Perkta is accompanied by a group of demonic-like assistants called Strugelli. These entities delight in partaking of the feast offerings left for them at Christmas as people hope for Perkta's blessings for prosperity and well-being in the upcoming year. In some instances, Strugelli are empowered to dish out punishments themselves, indiscriminately seizing and tearing apart misbehaving children in midair. So those are some of the more obscure Christmas monsters that I could find. And I think Laura has a little bit more information on both of those.
So now you said that other part of it was that took place in Switzerland?
Switzerland, yeah.
So that's really interesting because I didn't come across that. With all of these stories, like I was saying, they vary from region to region and everything is different. So from what I have is very similar, but it's also different. So I'm going to go into what I have with Perkta. And Frau Perkta, she was a witch-like creature with a beaked iron horn nose, dressed in rags, resembling an old decrepit crone holding a cane. She had a splayed foot, which is possibly from spinning too much, or it was also a goose foot, and it was possible that she was a shapeshifter. She's depicted very similar to Baba Yaga, which is a Hungarian hag and goes into folklore of that region, which I'm not going to go into because that's just a whole other sidestep, a whole other branch of this. Baba Yaga also had an iron nose and she was a forest witch who sat at a spinning wheel who had a very large bird foot. So Perkta's lore originated in the south of Germany and the Alpine area of Austria. Frau Perkta would carry a long knife under her skirt, and you were supposed to have all of your flax spun into thread by the 12th night of January 6th, which is also known for being the Feast of Epiphany. Because after Christmas, it was the time to set up your loom for weaving, and you were supposed to have all your wool spun also. So if she came to your house and found that your house was unorganized, your flax or your wool wasn't all spun and all ready to go, And if you did not leave a bowl of porridge out for her, she would come into your bedroom and take the knife out from underneath her skirt and gut you. She would disembowel you and take all your intestines out and replace them with straw and rocks. And in those days, spinning was necessary for survival. It meant that you could keep warm. And she was also the leader of the Perkton, which was terrifying demons that ran with her. Perkton parades became popular, where men would dress up as these terrifying creatures, wearing masks covered in horns and hair. And this was done to scare away the winter ghosts, evil spirits, anything associated with darkness, and Perkta and her followers. And these were very similar to the Krampus Lofts or the Krampus Runs. If you want to go back into more of the pagan times, before she came Perkta, her name was Berkta. And this is a word derived from birch, as in birch tree. The connection of Berkta and the birch tree is from Scandinavia. The rune Berkano is named for birch tree. And she was this beautiful Germanic goddess with long black hair that she braided, and the braids would encircle her head. She wore a long white gown with a belt around her waist with three golden keys that would hang from this belt, and they would represent birth, death, and rebirth. She was also known for having a goose foot. It said that she could shapeshift into a goose. She lived under evergreen trees in the mountains, and she was a protector of women, children, and wildlife, which is why they thought that she could kind of transfer into a goose, because she was protector of wildlife. In olden times, it was very common for children or infants to pass away from birth. So she was a very loving mother figure that would come for their souls and help guide them into the afterlife and protect them. So she was this very beautiful figure. She was also known for being motherlike, when she would punish children who needed to be punished, but she would also reward those who were pure of heart. Her name has also been found in German folklore as the Germanic goddess Holda, Frau Berkta, or Frau Holly. And had said Hole? I don't know if I'm pronouncing it wrong. I think we were talking about the same person.
Could be. Very well could be.
So I think we probably were, but I don't know the pronunciation. Mm-mm. And she's actually still talked about today. Every winter, she shakes her feathered bed out, and this is what creates the first snowfall of the year. Frau Holly, a winter goddess whose name means shining or bright, her association with Epiphany, which means shining bright. They also say it's possible that she was worshipped by Celtic tribes in the Alpine regions before Germanic tribes. So she goes back a very long way. And she's also associated with the ancient fertility god Nerthus. I butchered that. I'm sorry. I really don't know how to pronounce that. But and she can also be associated with the wild hunt gods Berchtold and Odin. And it's also said that she may have been the same deity as La Befana. And La Befana was the Italian Christmas witch, who also can be dated back to pagan times. La Befana was an old woman who would fly through the skies the eve of Epiphany, January 5th, sweeping all the negative away from the past year. And she would fly to children's houses, and she would leave them gifts while everybody was sleeping. And before she left, she would clean your house. Oh. So she's still, yeah, she sounds like a freaking treat.
Yeah.
She's actually still celebrated in Italy today. Jumping back to Berkta, Grimm Brothers even wrote about her, and there was a Berkta cult in the Black Forest in Germany, through the Alps of Switzerland, Austria, Czech Republic, Slovakia, France, Northern Italy, all before the rise of the church. They also wrote about Mother Holly, who is a fairy godmother. She punishes children for misbehaving or rewards them for being good. I also have this passage that I pulled from a source, and I'm just going to read it. Birgitta was a beloved goddess who protected babies, children, and women. Through Grimm's writings, we see glimpses into a past Germany where Birgitta was a psychopomp, a guide to the afterlife, caring especially for babies and children's souls. Gently like a mother, she led them to the next life. In one tale in which a grieving mother spots her recently deceased little boy following a group of children alongside a hillside. The children are following a motherly woman in white. Oh. A motherly woman in a white gown. The boy breaks away to address his sorrowful mother. In his hands, he shows her a bucket of water, which he says is his mother's tears. Then he tells her not to weep for him, for he is safe and sound under the white lady's watch, Birgitta. Eventually, Christianity began to take over and did not want people worshiping pagan gods, so they demonized her, and they turned her in to Birgitta, the ugly old evil crone that she's known for today. When they demonized her, they also decided that they were going to have her and her Birgitten joining Odin's wild hunt, sometimes even leading it. So that brings me into a whole realm of possibilities. And I know you know where I'm going with this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it strikes me as so interesting about how these stories all kind of intertwine. You know, there's all these little threads that tie into so many different pieces of the pie. That part's the most interesting portion to me.
I had this whole moment because I did my research and then I finished it up this morning, but I didn't come across the actual text that said the woman in white till this morning. So before I did this, I think it was before I finished my research this morning when I got up, I was kind of like in a half asleep state. And don't ask me how, don't ask me why, my brain's like turning and I'm thinking, okay, so the Bible says that thou shall have no other gods before me, meaning that, okay, yes, there are other gods, but the God in the Bible is the one and only God that you should be worshiping, not these other ones. So I'm thinking, okay, there are these other gods, there's Birgitta. And she is known as a woman in white. So all these sightings of women in white, and we had even done the story on the, I think it was the Appalachian Railroad stories, where there was it not that there was a small child, mm-hmm. little girl, who was seen in a white dress?
And also the Hitchhiker one, too. Hitchhiker had a woman in white, too.
Yeah. So I'm like, holy shit. Does she not come for all these souls of these women and children, bringing them into the afterlife, and they're wearing a white dress because that's what she's seen wearing?
You know,
here's
another part.
Holy crap.
When you see a picture of Jesus, what does he wear? A white robe. You think that's coincidence?
No, there's something tied into that.
Not at all.
Yeah, so that was just mind-blowing to me. I do have another thing that ties into some stuff with the large bird foot. There's also these theories, like there's been these things where there's stories that people find large bird-footed prints, like to this day, out in the wilderness, that just don't make sense. And it's only one print. So it kind of associates into this where there's this like shape-shifting, paranormal, supernatural creature with just one giant bird foot, going back into the Baba Yaga and Birgitta mm-hmm. and Birgitta. And it also, there's also been things where it kind of ties this large bird-like foot into Bigfoot, too.
Oh, really?
So it's this whole, yeah, there's a whole, I mean, we should probably even go into that in another episode because this is just this whole mess of stuff. So it's kind of like, I was worried for a while that maybe we were sounding boring giving all these history, but you really need to have the history and the backstory to get into this, because all of this history takes you down this giant road and brings you into all this paranormal stuff. And it's just like mind blown.
The saying that really strikes me here is the more things change, the more they stay the same. So the stories from long ago have been morphed into stories today. And if you know your history, it can give you a little bit more insight onto how those stories came to be.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, like, look at the stuff we have now with the Elf on the Shelf, which I absolutely hate, but that's another thing that we have for kids. You know, you better behave because Elf on the Shelf is watching.
I think you're absolutely right there, is that all these stories are all intertwined. I mean, all of them, you know, even if it's just the smallest little thread, you can connect it to something else and connect that to something else. And it just kind of leads to like a larger overarching story of like human history and how we've dealt with like surviving, you know, especially in the, you know, the ancient times, and how we just kind of carry those oral traditions even into present day. We're all modern and whatnot, but we still use these stories to keep our kids in line. It's really cool. I really enjoyed that.
It is really cool. And you said it's like these little threads, and it's like, I just want to keep pulling at them. And then the more you pull, it just becomes this giant matted nest that it's so hard to sort and sift through. Because I was finding myself getting like really irritated almost, because if I didn't already know some of the history, I would be pretty lost while I was researching some of this stuff, because it just gets into so much stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And try to keep the whole story straight. You know, you really mm-hmm. need to start at the beginning, because, you know, the beginning stories are fairly simple. Right. But then, you know, it's kind of like a branching tree, you know, the trunk, you start with the simple stuff and it just branches in this huge tree, and trying to keep it all straight is a project.
Exactly. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed this. This is something that I could just talk about for hours and hours, because I just find it so fascinating. And I hope that you guys listening enjoyed it also. I hope you got something from this and found something from this. And if you're from other countries, or you're from wherever, you know, send us an email. Let us know if there's something, some traditions that we don't know about. Tell us about them, because I certainly want to hear them, and I know you do too.
Oh, absolutely. I love learning new things. I learning other traditions from other countries, because to me, it's, you know, all interconnected once again. You know, there's a lot of traditions from Europe versus South America that, even though they weren't connected, they still have common threads between both of them. It's really interesting to see those two come together. So, yes, if you have interesting stories, please just send us a little email with, say, hey, check out such and such. You know, we'll look into it and it'll be fun.
And that, Just to go back, I mean, like, the whole Bertha thing made me angry and made me sad, honestly, because she's just this beautiful figure, this goddess, this woman. And I mean, I am Christian. I believe in God, but it just made me angry. It's like they just destroyed her. They made her this completely opposite of what she was. And it's like, there's got to be some truth to something, because women in white sightings and everything.
You could always say, you know, the Christian church is, or the, you know, Christianity has basically taken what it's wanted from all these other things and made it into their own. And if it didn't tell their story, quote unquote.
Yeah, fit their narrative.
Exactly. Then they just change it to whatever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we could go on and on throughout the year, though, how Christianity is subverted the older traditions into their own, which I think we've done a good job the last couple episodes, just kind of showing how Christianity is done, especially, you know, with Christmas being linked to Jesus so much, that how they really took all those traditions and just kind of made them into the quote unquote Christian holiday.
That's a good point. I think we did a pretty decent job, because it's not easy to gather all that and do it. So,
because we're, you know, you're talking everywhere from zero AD to today. And I mean, that's 2,000 years worth of history. And try to condense it down to our, or, you know, an hour long podcast.
Yeah, there's so many times where I'm like, okay, no, just stay in your lane and keep going with this. Don't get sidetracked because that's a whole other tangent. Yep. So
stay in your lane, Laura. I would wish everybody a very Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year's. I will be traveling for Christmas this year. Yeah, I'm going to go up and visit my sister. And I really looking forward to getting to a new year and seeing where that leads us.
Yeah, and I want to do the same. I mean, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Yule, Happy Winter Solstice, whatever you celebrate. Hope it's a good time for everybody. Everybody stay safe. And I think that's all we got. I think we'll probably see you actually in the new year.
Oh, and if anybody that's listening has snow and wants to send me pictures of snow, I would love that.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen for us either this year, sadly.
Definitely not going to happen for me this year.
All right, guys. So we will talk to you next time. And I'm going to put all the links in the show notes where you can find us. And we will see you later.
Goodbye, everyone.